Hello, my name is Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast, number 28, for August 25th, 2014. Update stories first, and then we'll get to the heavy lifting. I was watching a Premier League Match of the Day show last night. This comes to North America on the NBC Sports Channel. And you know, it's good. If you want to watch soccer, this is how you have to do it. ESPN has almost no soccer, and the soccer they'd have is North American teams. I don't want to watch North American teams. So Match of the Day sounds pretty good, right? 1 hour show showing the very best moments of the soccer games, I guess, that happened yesterday or the day before. Halfway through, I just went, hey, wait a minute. There's something I'm not seeing here. And I counted. I watched 30 replays in two games. So they took, on average, the 15 greatest moments per game from two games. And this was, you know, goals, but it was also good saves by the goalie or near misses or all that kind of stuff. And I never saw any dribbling at all. I never saw one time where a guy with the ball went around another guy. It simply never happened. Now, one of my premises of my soccer video is saying that English teams, in particular, they don't dribble. They're constantly kicking the ball in a, well, in football you call it a Hail Mary. In a very optimistic way, they're just kicking the ball in the general direction of where they want to be, where they want to score a goal. And they're hoping their own teammate will get the ball and somehow be able to do something with it. The South American style is a control style and a dribbling style. And it's beautiful. So these 30 plays they were showing, there wasn't any beauty anywhere in these plays. It astounds me. I can't believe that this is considered the, well, outside of North America, this is the premium sports league in the world. So this is the very best sporting people in the world, all brought together, dozens of them on the field at once. No dribbling. Now, part of it, you have to say, and again, I talked about this in my soccer video, is that if you don't defend the great players, they don't get a chance to be great. They don't get a chance to show their stuff. You know, Messi's obviously the standout when it comes to dribbling, but there are other good dribblers. Well, if the game is basically too violent, too much contact, incidental contact, oops, sorry, didn't mean to shove you, contact, then they can't shine, and you have no choice but to basically just try and pass the ball. As soon as you've got the ball, they're physically on you, and it's just a matter of a second or two before you're going to be removed from the ball by force. Soccer is a blunt instrument. I was reading or watching somewhere, and they were saying that it used to be called the beautiful game, or it got that name originally, because it was simple. The rules were simple. Well, two things need to happen. The rules need to get more complicated, and you need to defend the rights of the great players to make it beautiful. Nothing in life these days is simple. Nothing at all. I remember with computer modems, there was a software I wanted to use called RBBS. I forget what the R stands for. BBS, Bulletin Board System. This is prior to the internet, and I wanted to set up a BBS for the philosophy that I was a member of. And by the way, I still consider myself a member in the most important area, the area of spirit, or I guess you could say I'm fundamentally a member. I'm never going to stop because I think the principles are sound. And in our lives, we have to find our own vehicles to accomplish what we're meant to accomplish. And I'm finding right now a vehicle that doesn't directly involve them. But of course, it indirectly involves the principles, right? Talking about names. Anyway, so I was working on the philosophy bulletin board, PBBO I called it, and I took RBBS, which was the dominant bulletin board software in the world at that time. It was freeware. They kept coming out with new versions. It was really an amazing program, so far ahead of its time. I guess I would say it was like Microsoft Windows for its time. And I went through this software from one end to the other. There were some back doors in the software, ways to break into the software that people put in for who knows what reason. No good reason, that's for sure. And the code was super compressed, compacted code. You could get 10 lines of instruction on one line, which made it difficult to read, to say the least. And so I sort of fattened out the code so that you could read it and understand it and, you know, put in critical comments. But it was geared around a US Robotics modem. They basically said, you have to have this modem. It will only work with this modem. Well, that in itself, right, is kind of creepy. Well, it turned out, I may have this wrong. Yeah, I do. It was built around the Hayes smart modem. And US Robotics came out with a compatible modem to the Hayes smart modem. And US Robotics, it's kind of like what Compaq did with IBM. IBM came out with a personal computer. You had to have an IBM personal computer. It wouldn't be compatible. And then Compaq reverse engineered, like in a clean room so you can't say we copied, they reinvented the IBM BIOS, the basic input-output instruction set. And by doing that, they had a perfect clone that wasn't a copy. And that's what started the personal computer revolution, really, was that now you could make cheap clones. So the US Robotics was a cheaper clone. I don't think I ever bought a US Robotics because they were still expensive. And then I eventually bought, it was probably a Chinese or Asian product of some kind, maybe Taiwanese or something. I bought a modem. And it was like a quarter of the price of the US Robotics. And it even came with a telephone built into it. Very elegant. I used the telephones from the system for years afterwards because you could just unplug the phone and then it was like a corded phone. And it had a nice big button that was your connect, disconnect, or dial tone, no dial tone button. So that when you rested the phone, the weight of the phone pushed down on this large button and it would disconnect or connect when you lifted it up. We got phones here now, you know, we got rid of the microwave, so we have corded phones, and these phones now, they have to have a base. They don't go off unless they go into their base, and that's really annoying, and why on earth did they do that? It's one of these things where one group doesn't know how to handle a product, so you have to change everybody's use of the product for the one group. That one group would be people that they answer the phone, and then they casually put it down and disconnect the conversation. Well, there are ways to put down a phone where you don't do that, right? Have it face up, not face down. But because of them, everyone has to put the phone back on the base or you haven't hung up. Anyway, I gotta remember, oh boy, what was the connection there to compatible products and RBBS? I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. How did I get there? From soccer. Oh dear. Compatible products. I don't remember the connection. Hopefully you do. And you're laughing at me right now. And that's the point, isn't it? Soccer is laughable. It's just beyond me. Oh yeah, this simple game. And it was originally, you know, very few rules. And it needs more rules. Oh, that's what it was. So, what was interesting I discovered, because I became sort of overly knowledgeable about modems, because it was like computers at that time. You knew which computers were truly compatible and which weren't and all that stuff. And I just remember reading dozens, hundreds of articles on different computers. HP came out with a 150 at one point. And this was a very advanced system. And all I remember is it wasn't fully compatible. It even had like a touch screen, which at that time was like black magic, that you could put your finger near the screen and it could detect where your finger was. I mean, honestly, when I saw that stuff happening, I thought, this will never be a mainstream product. And now with our smartphones, you put your finger on the screen and it knows where your finger is. It's really astounding. So at that time, with modems, I was constantly aware of modems. And I remember, I think I was working on someone's computer because you started to get internal built-in modems. And I remember wanting to get the drivers. Drivers are the connection, the interface between a piece of hardware and another piece of hardware. So a modem is hardware, your computer is hardware, and then you have to connect them with instructions so that each knows how to talk to the other. And drivers, you know, Windows has tens of thousands of drivers, Microsoft Windows. And they even have what they call HAL, the hardware abstraction layer. And what that means is no matter what your device does, we can abstract it. And we can come up with this layer which will talk to it. And the point is that then Windows doesn't need to know. The user doesn't need to know. The people designing Windows programs, they don't need to know. It's all taken care of at lower levels. So that abstraction is really a phenomenal thing. Computers are that. They are that abstracting thing. I mean, just think about it. I'm able to talk in one room, you hear in another room, or on the go. And it's all because the nitty-gritty of those different media are taken care of. And so I don't need to know any of that. You don't need to know any of that. You don't need to know how I'm recording this. I don't need to know how you're listening to it. It's completely separate, completely abstracted. Well, when I remember trying to get the drivers for this modem and I went onto the US Robotics website, they had hundreds of models of their modem. My brain promptly exploded when I saw this. I was like, what the heck? There's one Hayes smart modem. There's one compatible US Robotics modem. Why all these different versions? And over the years, I realized this is how these companies made money. There's no money in one version. There's no money in 10 versions. You need 1,000 versions. I was drinking a portion of a soda yesterday after working kind of hard. I allow myself a treat of a few ounces of soda. And it's in a new 1.5 liter bottle. So that's not a 2 liter bottle. It's not the old 25 or 26 ounce bottle. It's not the 3 liter bottles that I've seen. It's not the 1 liter bottle that I've seen advertised. It's 1.5 liters. Well, what's going on there? I think there's only one thing going on there. It's shelf space. And you keep coming up with different sizes of bottles. You give the supermarket no choice. They carry all the sizes, or you walk. They carry all the sizes, or they don't get their discount. This is our world. There's no value added in a 1.5 liter size. No one was asking for that. Were you asking for a 1.5 liter size? Do you even know how big it is? Do you have anything to equate it to? Yeah, I had the 1 liter size and it just wasn't big enough. And then I got the 2 liter size and I almost got a hernia. We're not doing that. We're not going through that process. It's artificially being done to us. So soccer, the simple game. You know, you can't call it beautiful based on simplicity. Soccer, the simple game. Needs another version. It doesn't have to have a lot of versions, but it needs version 2. And in version 2, you add some rules. It's interesting, DOS, the disk operating system for all computers before Windows. In version 1, I can guarantee that virtually no one listening to this used version 1. I didn't. I started with version 2. And then, of course, 3.3 became a real landmark version. 4 was a mistake, just like the number itself is a test. Well, DOS 4 was a disaster and a test. And then 5 is the rapid growth. DOS 5, that became like the next level, and it started to have some advantages over any other version. The big thing with DOS 5 was memory management. At that time, you had to buy memory managing programs, separate programs. And DOS 5 came with just enough of that, that you didn't have to buy these other programs. And then DOS 6 was really like a stability release. You know, in Slashdot, they're sort of contemptuous of DOS 6, but... And I remember it was DOS 6, 6.1, 6.... I don't know about 6.1, but 6.2, and then 6.22, I think, was the final version of DOS before Windows completely took over. But those 6s and 6.22 and that, they had little features that were nice little features. And I remember upgrading all of our systems, buying all the upgrade. At that time, you'd buy the whole upgrade product. And then having like a shelf full of nothing but these manuals for these products. You know, the amount of waste. And it's all because software companies want to make money. And they could sell you the, here's one disc for your 30 copies or whatever it was. They could do it that way. But then you would expect a discount. And they don't want a discount, so they're like, yeah, you go ahead and we'll send you however many copies you want. You know, we'll chop down trees just for you. But anyway, each version of DOS, you know, kind of reflected the numbers. And things started happening that were good at version 2. Version 1 is rarely good enough. Very rarely. As I'm talking here, I'm going to try and think of a product that was good enough at version 1. And here's one, maybe. Napster. Now, I don't know what the versions of Napster are. I doubt anybody does. But it seemed like Napster came along, and suddenly it was good. But when I think about it, competitors came out, and they could do more than Napster. And in a sense, they were the version too, right? In other words, if you don't upgrade yourself, someone else will do the upgrading, and you get left in the dust. Windows 1 was junk. I'm trying to remember, Windows 286 was technically like the Windows 2. And that's when XL came out. XL required Windows, first product. People were kind of shocked by that. And to require Windows, you know, you could see, well, it'll work with Windows, but this product required Windows. And then you realized, oh, it's using some of the Windows memory management. And at that time, Windows was allowing a way to use your additional memory. Now, there were other types of memory. There were other ways to use that memory. But then, you know, it's warring standards. And basically, Microsoft won just by being the biggest, not really from doing a better job necessarily. And then for stability, I think it was Windows 3 came out, made some big gains, but then I think it was 3.1 where they did the 3D interface where basically you had shadows. Using shadows and slight color changes, things started to have a depth. Like as I'm looking at this recording window right now, it appears to be raised above the background image. And that's using 3D, which by the way, Windows 8, they took all that away. Windows 8 is just this wonderful downgrade. This is the genius of Microsoft. It's kind of like the US Robotics coming out with all those different versions. With software, it's a little different. If you come up with a new version, people can ignore it. And so Microsoft has this advantage, this market advantage, where when you buy a new computer, it has Windows on it. And they've made that happen. And so they leverage that advantage by forcing everyone to have every once in a while to have a lousy version of Windows. And then, of course, when the next version comes out, you're going to upgrade. Windows Vista was and is considered a lousy version of Windows. And so when Windows 7 comes out, people have to upgrade. Well, Windows 8 is going to force upgrades to Windows 9. They're fine with that. They have a monopoly. Yeah, it's technically possible for you to install other operating systems on your computer. And one computer in 100 has something else on it. That leads to 99. So Windows is targeted at the 99 out of 100. So downgrades are a big part. It's just really ironic. Because really with the US Robotics, when they were coming out with hundreds of versions, I guarantee you that the differences between one and the next were almost zero. They had a different serial number, a different product number. And, you know, technically if you pursued it far enough, you would find, oh, there's a microscopic difference one to the next. But it was different products. And when you get different products, what happens is it actually becomes hard to support it, and then you give up. They do this all the time. In storage devices, I buy storage devices from time to time, and they'll just change it. They'll change the styling. They'll change the look. They'll change, worse, the most annoying thing is they'll change the power supply. These external, you know, storage devices typically need their own power supply, and they'll change them. You'll be going along, and now it's changed. Well, now you have to inventory all that. You have to keep track of all that. And what happens is it devalues the products before. So after a while, that product from before is now 3 years old, and, oh yeah, it uses that different power supply. And then you want to get rid of it. So this is all, you know, you could call it planned obsolescence with the car industry. They use that term, planned obsolescence. And, yeah, there's some of that where the thing is designed to break. Some of these USB connectors are truly a disaster. One of these connectors is so bad, my wife has it on her phone. And someone on Slashdot humorously said that the way you operate this connector is you put it in and it's wrong. And then you turn it over and you put it in again and it's wrong. And then you take it out and you turn it over again and you put it in and it's right. In other words, it was right the first time, but it's possible to have it the right way up, and then still you can bend the pins over on this stupid interface, this stupid connector. What a nightmare. Well, there are many USB interfaces. There are many different connectors, and this one offers nothing compared to the one I'm thinking of. It's about the same size, microscopically thicker, and just a better design thing that nothing ever goes wrong with it. Like all the other USB connectors, but this one mini one, whatever it is, got some code name to it. It's a disaster. On purpose. And you get your expensive smartphone and you break off your USB connector, now what? That's how you charge it. That's how you suck photos out of it or whatever you do with your phone. But mostly, that's how you charge it. You break that off. They know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. So, soccer. Watching those plays yesterday, really, truly pathetic. If I was the type to shout at the TV, I would be shouting when I was watching that stuff. But instead, I just kept saying over and over again, pathetic, I can't believe it. No dribbling. Wow, the unbeautiful game. Version 1. All right, I wanted to do something first, and then I was going to launch into my Wi-Fi madness. I've got some large number of stories once again. I try not to torture you guys every episode, every week with wireless stuff, but of course the industry marches on. So this time I didn't sort them. You know, last time I sorted them into 6 categories, which was nice of me on my part to do all that. But I'm just going to take a different take on it. And the different take is I'm going to go in reverse order, so the most recent ones first. So yesterday's story, securing networks in the Internet of Things era. Well, this is what's not really considered by the consumer. These Internet of Things devices, these little gadgets that you wear and yada yada, they are a security nightmare. They need every bit as much security as your personal computer. But your personal computer has evolved defenses for decades. Decades. I had an antivirus, trying to work it out. It was about almost 30 years ago. I was big into antiviruses. I was really aware of it. I upgraded them and everything else. And, of course, at that time, no one had them. No one had an antivirus. It's kind of mind-boggling. Well, we're like that with the Internet of Things. And what's worse is, with your computer, you can install a product. With these handheld devices, sometimes you can install a product, but often you can't configure it the way you would like. And the product doesn't tell you, hey, you know, I'm actually kind of deficient. I'm not a very good product, you should get another product. There are millions of these products. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of these products in the App Store and, you know, the various places where you buy phone applications. And it's ironic, but it's much more of a mess than the personal computer market ever was. This has been a sort of a, kind of a disgusting trend over the years. In the early days of computers, you couldn't do stuff. And then, you know, products like Turbo Pascal or Borland's Sidekick came out, and these were ingenious products. And then you were like, whoa, there's some geniuses out there. And then you started keeping an eye out for these genius products, and you'd read the magazines and learn about them, and then you'd, like, get one of these genius products. It was like, wow, you know, just to have Sidekick installed, it became like an indispensable, awesome program. Then you started having multiples where, you know, Company A came out with a Sidekick-like product, and Company B and Company C. And then, you know, of course, companies like Microsoft would build in some of that functionality. You could argue that Windows itself was kind of like Sidekick. It was like all these programs you could run along with your main program. You know, Windows came with a calculator just like Sidekick. And then you had sort of a battle where the number of players decreased. You know, WordPerfect went out of business. CorelDRAW, I don't know, diminished anyway. I think it might still be kicking, but I don't know how big it is. Quark Express was phenomenal, and then it went away. And different products have come and gone, and basically you've had consolidation. I remember Egghead Software. You'd go in there to buy software. And I remember Egghead Software going out of business. And that's because there was so much consolidation in the industry, and users only needed a few programs, if that. And, of course, now today, you know, the average person going on Facebook and doing email and whatnot, they need a browser. Maybe they need a word processor. That's about it. The average person uses 2 programs, not counting Solitaire or their video game. So then we had a period where computers were adequate, right? The software was adequate. Well, when you want to do a little bit more with your computer, then you have to find the tools to do that. And some people would argue, yeah, that's why you get an Apple, because Apple has all these tools. Well, Apple has one of each of those tools. And maybe I'll save my Apple rant for another time, but I can't stand Apple products. They're dumbed down. They choose what you get to do, and that's it. Well, smartphones, tablets, they're like a dumber product than an Apple. you get less choice. You get less interface, less keyboard to interact with the smart programs. And for some reason, these app stores have allowed tens and hundreds of thousands of products to appear in their app store. Maybe it's the guy at home thinking, hey, I could make a buck off of putting this app in the app store. It's a bad vetting process, it's a bad evaluation process by the app store where they don't kick out the garbage. But it's the Wild West again. We have gone full circle. Or actually, we're at a place where we never were before, where you have 100,000. It's kind of like the TV comment where you have 500 channels and nothing is on. Well, in the App Store, you have 100,000 channels and nothing is any good. And in security, for sure, the average phone, the average person, let's say 999 out of 1,000 people are using dangerously insecure devices. So, I mean, here I am at the first story. 7 minutes on the first story. Here's the quote here. Gartner reckons that the number of connected devices will hit 26 billion in another 6 years. That's 4 connected devices per person. And they say that's 30 times the number of devices connected to the Internet of Things in 2009. The IoT will represent the biggest change to our relationship with the Internet, blah, blah, blah. The IoT devices themselves suffer from security limitations as a result of their minimal computing capabilities. Yeah. You know, figuratively, when you have a smart, and this is always in quotes for me, when you have a smart toothbrush, what are you expecting from it? What kind of a processor is it going to have? How much memory? How many gigabytes? What kind of a firewall? Well, forget it. It's a simple device. And it's going to burp out its wireless message, and it's going to be counting on something smarter than it to pick up that message. Hey, I need more floss, is what the device is going to say. And some other device is going to go, oh, let me look it up. Oh, the toothbrush device needs more floss. The majority don't support sufficiently robust mechanisms for authentication. Well, authentication is you proving who you are. On the personal computer, you know, that's why we have these super long passwords now, and they're changing all the time, and it's a total hassle, right? Well, on these simple devices, they have none of that. So they either have no authentication at all, or they have a burned-in password. Well, burned-in equals somebody knows what it is, and it can be exploited. And when you have no authentication, well, one thing can impersonate another thing. As a result, it can be difficult for organizations to provide secure network access for certain IoT devices. No kidding. This is just a total nightmare, total can of worms, and for garbage, as we'll see. So that story was August 23rd, yesterday, and then a week ago, August 16th, Swarm Portland. The event, dubbed Swarm Portland, aimed to draw attention to Oregon's bee die-offs, which have been linked to pesticides, starvation, and other factors. In my comment, I say, have they now? I've noticed in our garden, we have all kinds of wasps. All kinds, small ones, big ones. I've been working outside, and lately it's become dangerous to work outside because this is the time of the year when the wasps are looking for a home for the winter. I don't understand their whole program, but I guess apparently they can survive the winter in, what, hibernation? Or do they lay eggs and then they die and the eggs survive? Or I don't know. But these wasps, at this time of year, are really determined to survive, and they do all kinds of bizarre things. They're all over the place. And bumblebees. Plenty of bumblebees. But not very many honeybees. Let's think about what's going on there. Because, of course, I maintain that, and I'm not the first here, but I side with the wireless is bad crowd when it comes to blaming wireless for bee die-offs. You know, they did the simple test. They put cordless phones in one set of hives and no cordless phone in another set of hives. And that's all they did. In the hives with the cordless phones, either no bees came back or very few bees came back. And in the other hives, it was business as usual. Well, gee, I don't know. Might be a trend there. So wasps are independents, basically. They don't come home and tap out a bee dance. They don't communicate with other bees and get the smell from them and have the other bee point. The flowers are in this direction. I would say a wasp is probably more like a dog. It's a scavenger. It's aggressive, if it has to be. And it's just looking for food, and it's just running around looking for food. And bumblebees are, of course, independent. they carry their whole house with them. So the ones that are independent, that don't need to communicate, are fine. The ones that need to communicate are not fine, because we are interfering with their communication. Isn't that obvious? Apparently not. All right, next story. August 15th. So we're going back one day, so 9 days ago, something like that. I was talking to the local work crew right outside there. They're doing a thing where they're upgrading the sewer system. And this is something that our world gradually falls apart, you know, as time marches on. And because they're sucking so much money out of the system with the Federal Reserve and other scams like that, there's not enough money to maintain things. And so we have to maintain it ourselves. So the richest people, they use the system, and they pay no more and probably less than the rest of us pay. And then we have to support the system because the richest don't pay anything. There was a story yesterday on Slashdot or somewhere talking about Microsoft, and they had like $80 billion offshore. What? And they were saying how much tax money they are saving by not having to declare that money where it is actually being made, i.e. it's being made in Redmond, Washington. That's the home of Microsoft, Washington State. And it turned out that it was like that money, that tax money, would be bigger than the Washington State budget. And all of that money is not going to happen just by, you know, the tax law game. Well, that tax law game means that we have to pay for our roads. And so what happens is these strategies have evolved to put Band-Aids on roads. There's a road 3 or 4 blocks away where they put tar on the road. And they put tar on the road for like a mile. The old days of tar roads are back, because the tar seals the road. You get cracks. The cracks freeze-thaw cycle, winter, summer. The water gets in, it freezes, and gradually your road is destroyed. Well, when you put tar on the road, you seal up the cracks. And it's not like paving it. It's not as good. It's like putting a Band-Aid on it. And the Band-Aid will last for a few years, and then it'll come off again, and then you're back where you were. But it was a lot cheaper than paving it again. Like in Canada, when I've seen them do this, they would follow the cracks. They would have a guy with a sort of a wand. Out of the wand would come liquid tar, and they would paint the cracks. And honestly, this makes more sense to me than anything, is to paint the cracks, because now you're making it even cheaper. It's even less tar. It's even less time. Yeah, it looks crappy at the end. You've got this spaghetti. It's like tossing spaghetti on the ground. You've got these random black lines, Nazca lines on the ground where you've covered up the cracks. But that's the only part of the road that's failing. And you can do that again 3 years from now, even cheaper than tarring the entire road. Well, with this road where we are here, it's a sewer thing. And it's a busier road, and, you know, you don't want your sewer line to fail. So, to put in a new sewer line, they got a problem. How do you put in a new sewer line? You've got one already. And it's in the way. And it's working. Well, sort of. So you have to put it in a new place. Well, that new place, they decided, was where the gas line was. Now, it sounds really bizarre at first, but I put together my own theory to explain it. The gas line is a fragile beast. If you have a smallest of cracks or weaknesses in a gas line, you have a leak. And these systems detect leaks by gas pressure and by having this stench that they put in with the gas. If that stench, if you smell that stench, well, then you have a leak. And also, as I say, through the pressure drop. So city decrees that they're going to put their new sewer line where the gas line is. And so I'm thinking that that means that they know that the gas line area is pretty integral. Well, now, of course, then the gas line has to move. And so what's been happening for like 2 weeks right outside here, we got front row seats. They have to like put the entire new gas line in, first stage, just the main pipe. And then they have to go back and cut in the services. Again, just like with the sewer, you've got a gas line and now you're putting a new one and you've got to run it independently. And then when you're ready, you have to dig up what you've done and tap in. So you disconnect the person from the old service, and then you connect them to the new service times every house. Huge thing. I think they said there was going to be a month, and it's for 2 blocks. So basically 50 houses is going to take a month. It's like a day's work per house average. Then, then sometime in the future, the city's going to come along and they're going to do the new sewer line, which should be a real fun time for everybody. So anyway, there was a crew member, and he was looking at our house, and he was like, I got to ask you, what's going on with that plastic on the walls of your house? And I'm like, oh, no, that's aluminum mesh. It's for the microwaves. And I start talking to him about the microwave problem. This guy, he just freaked out. I mean, his eyes are bulging. He kept saying, I didn't know that. And then he'd say, important information. How come I didn't know about that? He kept saying this over and over again. You know, after having a good chat with him, I went, and I realized, hey, I can get the meter and I can show him the numbers, you know, and it's so dynamic. You need to show someone that here is one number and 2 feet away can be double. And in our case here, it's very predictable that if you go higher up, the numbers get bigger. So I was like talking to him, and at ground level, it's 10 times higher than it should be. And then you just hold the meter up, you know, 1.5 feet higher, and then it's now 20 times higher than it should be. And then I'm telling him, like, in this block where you guys are working right now, the levels are 3 times higher than the FCC maximum limit. They're 3 times higher than they're allowed to be. And you guys are working in this. And I talked about it being a sleep robber. That's the most important impact. That's the easiest one to test. Turn off your computer router and turn off your cordless phone base when you sleep. Try it. Turn those 2 things off, nothing else. Of course, I assume you don't have your smartphone right next to your bed. You know, basically turn off the 2 or 3 main sources of microwaves while you're trying to sleep. And watch what happens. For the people under this roof, the change in sleep has been completely revolutionary. And by itself, the personal lifetime benefit of that is probably $10,000 or $20,000 to me. Just the sleep factor alone. And of course, not to mention that you rebuild your body during sleep. People who are having trouble sleeping, they're having trouble rebuilding. As I said to this crew, you guys work physically, I've worked physically. How important is it for you guys to get a good night's sleep? They're like, it's huge, you got to get that. And I point to the block they're working on and I say, I guarantee you that no one in these blocks is sleeping very well. Guarantee it. Anyway, so August 14th, 10 days ago, Gartner. The Internet of Things has reached the hype peak. Well, I wish that was true. And then there was a comment on Slashdot about this story. By the way, Internet of Things, this thing that's going to bring us 10 times as much wireless as we already have, is a 775. It's an accident looking for a place to happen. Isn't that sweet? So this Slashdot comment said, why buzzwords are bad? And he says, the Internet of Things is a redundant concept. Just like the cloud, we're hearing these days about the cloud. It's all just the Internet, he says. And he's right. The fact that you hook up your bike tire to a sensor so you get an email when your air is low isn't a new thing that should be given a name. It's just a further application of an existing technology. And then here's a punchy quote. Big Brother and his capitalist cousin want the Internet of Things to control our behavior. The cloud is a way to get you to put all your data with one carrier, whether it's Google, Apple, whoever. They want to have as much of your behavior on their system as possible. Then he says, so there's a component of dishonesty. Well, I say there's a whole lot more than a component. It's total dishonesty. It's total hypeware. It's total a wolf in sheep's clothing, just like my original article name. The cloud and the Internet of Things were phrases chosen to obscure and confuse meaning, not communicate it. Well, it was a good Slashdot comment. All right, so going back now, 17 days to August 7th, Google today released a preview SDK of Google Fit. An SDK is a software development kit. Google Fit is the stuff you wear on yourself when you go for a jog that tells Google what your heartbeat is. And so when you release an SDK, well, now everyone can write an application that talks to your Google Fit, your little Fitbit, right? The one that burned your hand with, what did it burn it with? Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, they never talked about that. Yeah, burning. Wonder what things burn. Wouldn't be like a microwave oven, would it? Nah, couldn't be. All right, August 4th, University of Washington engineers have designed a new communication system that uses radio frequency signals as a power source. Well, aren't they great? And by the way, right in the link it says, no power. Wi-Fi connectivity could fuel Internet of Things. Well, it's no power power. The Wi-Fi, the wireless, the microwaves, is the power. Well, of course, it turns out the NSA has been doing this for 6 years, but besides that, this is a disaster. Microwaves are bad for us in the super small quantities that we're currently getting them. My meter measures in microwatts per meter squared. Well, a meter's big, so a meter squared is like your kitchen table. And it's measuring a number, and the healthy number inside your house is 1 microwatt per meter squared, so 1 millionth of a watt over your kitchen table area. And your microwave, even despite the shielding, is putting out 70,000 microwatts per meter squared, but that's still 0.07 watts per meter squared, while your hairdryer puts out 1,200. So compare 0.07, let's call it 0.1 for round figures, to 1,200. Your hairdryer puts out 12,000 times as much energy as your cell phone. When you start talking about using radio frequency as a power source, well, then the radio frequency has to be very high energy to do that. No one talks about that. There's no discussion of that at all. It's just, aren't these guys wonderful? Thank goodness. All right, 2 days before that, August 2nd, wearable devices and associated apps, trackable and unsecure. I think that should be insecure, but that's what the headline was. Well, we've talked about the insecurity of these apps. We've talked about the trackability of these apps. No one's thinking about this. When you have the ability to protect yourself, people will write an article and they'll say, click here to check your system. Click here to get the latest drivers that don't have this bug that we just found. But when you have a smartphone, there's nothing to click. You can't just fix these devices. So the guys can't write stories to tell you, hey, click here to fix your smart device. You're out of luck. So what is anyone to do? If someone wants to help you, what are they to do? They can't do anything. They could tell you, take your smartphone and smash it into the ground. And that would be good advice. And that's about all they can tell you. August 1st. This was a commercial. It's currently running right now. There's variations. But the first one I saw was August 1st. And it's two kids with smartphones. And they're teaching the grown-ups about the smartphones. And of course, one kid wears those perfect, you know, you look like an owl glasses. And he's the guru, you know, they're both gurus, but he's the obvious, you know, genius guru that is teaching the grown-ups. Well, yeah, the smartphone trend is a trend where the young are teaching the old, for sure. The young are gullible, naive, impulsive, and have just enough ego to be dangerous to themselves. And so they embrace these things. And so now they have to show off and one-up their parents, right? And then the parents will sort of go, oh, well, I guess we should. So getting back into July 27, the emerging smart city. I'm just trying to see what I should talk about here. Some infrastructure, smart city. I'm just scanning through. Because this story was a mix of stories. And they're comparing Sao Paulo. While the transformation of Sao Paulo into a smart city through the adoption of new technological tools and the expansion of physical infrastructure is the order of the day for many stakeholders. Just look at that phrase. This is a... I was going to say New York Times. It seems like a New York Times article. It seems so cheesy. It's hard to read. What matters first and foremost for the future of the metropolis is its spatial reorganization, lest these new technologies become accessories to the chaos. And there's some talking about Beijing here. Anyway, I'll have the link here. It's fairly unbearable, but what gets my attention is the smart city, right? The smart concept. You know, the smartphone is smart for one group of people, the group of people that want a whole lot of us to die off. And the sooner the better. So I say, just as a comment to this kind of crappy story, what a massive load of choose your word. They are trying their hardest to make the smart movement happen. And then I say, boy, they must stand to gain a lot from it. All right, same day. Passengers demand faster in-flight Wi-Fi. Now, isn't this lovely? On your flight, whether you want it or not, you have the people around you demanding not just Wi-Fi, not just radiation while you're flying. As if you don't get enough already from being in the thinner air. I think it's like a flight equals a chest x-ray or something like that. So you've already got radiation that everyone acknowledges is damaging, and now you want to up the Wi-Fi radiation. And passengers are demanding it, according to this story. Oh, dear. And who's demanding that it not be there? Who's demanding a radiation-free flight? Who's demanding a part of the airplane be a Faraday cage where there's no radiation? Well, no one's demanding that. I mean, there probably are some that want that. but no voice the media is going to print. That's not what they want. The media and these wireless companies are working hand in hand. One is selling the other. All right, July 26th, the day before that story. Private data on iOS devices not so private. Personal data, including text messages, contact lists, and photos, can be extracted from iPhones through previously unpublicized techniques by Apple employees, the company acknowledged this week. They can just go through your pockets. Oh, look what we found in his pocket. A week earlier, July 17, how easy it is for hackers to control your hotel room. Jesus Molina, who was staying at the St. Regis Shenzhen Hotel, I think that would be in China, found that he could easily take control of the thermostats, lights, TVs, and window blinds in all of the hotel's 250-plus rooms, as well as alter the electronic Do Not Disturb lights outside each door, all from the comfort of his luxurious bed. He'll be presenting his findings at the Black Hat Security Conference in August. If this doesn't just turn you off of smart stuff, I don't know what will. I really don't. All right, July 12. Smart light bulbs reveal Wi-Fi passwords. All right. Well, we all need smart light bulbs, don't we? I mean, how are you supposed to get smart reading unless your light bulb is smart? Every child should be required by law to have smart light bulbs. Judges, for sure, should have smart light bulbs. Teachers, of course. Teachers should be teaching light bulbs how to be smart. And they reveal Wi-Fi passwords. Well, that's the whole point. Weak devices weaken an entire system. In this case, I was trying to think of a physical analogy. At first, I was thinking, well, you have a fence around a perimeter. I guess smart devices are like taking part of your fence and turning it into a kiosk. And then it turns out there's an easy way to just jump over the top of the kiosk. So now you've lost your fence, and the bad guys, though, they don't need the kiosk. They want to get inside. July 11, FCC approves plan to spend $5 billion over the next 5 years on school Wi-Fi. And this is a new mandate to revamp the E-Rate program, which pays for telecom services for schools. They're going to phase out funding for voice service, web hosting, and paging services, and redirect all that money to Wi-Fi, to radiation. So this is the government using money that's currently going into useful services, and all of that's going to be deleted, and instead, your kids are going to be bombarded with increased radiation at school. The government cares, don't they? July the 8th, Fit RPG turns your Fitbit into a game you play with friends. Are the radiation burns as part of the game? I'm not sure. It doesn't say in the story. Same day, Wired, these weird rainbow ghosts show how Wi-Fi signals are shaped. This was kind of interesting. I'll have this link up. A guy has managed to take pictures of what Wi-Fi signals look like, what the radiation signature or profile. It's like when you, on a hot day, you can see the heat shimmering on the road. Well, this guy's done it better than that with color and really created some spectacular images, but it shows you. Okay, here's a little excerpt I've got here. The most shocking thing about his pictures is how different signals can be in almost the exact same spot. Well, this is, of course, what I've been saying, right? You need a Wi-Fi meter, because meter results can differ by a factor of 10, pretty commonly, 2 feet away. And, of course, when you scale it up to the size of your house and that pesky cell phone tower outside, you need to know, where's the radiation coming from? Like in our case, when I first started measuring and protecting, I was worried about the front of the house. The front of the house is the physically closest part to these cell phone towers. But it turns out that the highest readings were on the side of the house, and they were 2.5 times as big as the front of the house reading. Actually, I think they were about double. 1,400 microwatts per meter squared inside of this house, and the healthy level is 1. So they were 1,400 times too high. But you measure another part of the house, and they were like 40. Pity the person getting the 1,400. Even the 40 it's on the edge. For me personally, in my intuition, 40 is when I stop trying to make it smaller. I wouldn't live with something in the 100 range or higher, personally. The 40 range, I'm living with it, and I have a whole lot more energy than I had before. So our quality of life has gone way up. But ideally, if they say it should be 1, it should be 1. Everything else they've said, the companies, the ones that truly care about us, you know, they know what they're saying with these recommendations, and they all say the same thing. And it's, by the way, 10 million times less than what the industry-funded organization says is healthy. They're saying the figure should be 10 million times less. That's 1,000,000,000%. When was the last time you heard 1,000,000,000%? When was the last time you heard something should be a factor of 10 million smaller? You'd be like, say you had a bank and you had 100,000 branches, and a security advisor came in and he said, you know, your security needs to be improved by a factor of 10 million. Well, if you have 100,000 branches and he's saying it has to be improved by a factor of 10 million, what he's saying is each branch is 100 times too weak. Every single one. It's like saying it has 100 flaws in it. Well, that's wireless. That's microwave radiation. 10 million times too strong. And by the way, that standard is when you stick the phone to your ear. When you hold the phone in your lap, well, all bets are off. Because the amount that is heating your head while you're holding it in your hand is very little. So they can crank up the juice, and they do. Believe me, I've measured it. It's way higher when it's in your hand than when you're on a call. It's like a cell phone call is, you know, someone using a machine gun. When it's in your hand, well, they're just using pocket nukes. Good Wired article on the Wi-Fi signals gives you some idea what you're dealing with, and like it says, how different the signals are can be in almost the exact same spot. Our wireless signals are fickle. They react to our bodies and the various materials around us. Yes, indeed. Fickle. What a nice word. We have fickle wireless. What kind of wireless do you have? Well, we don't have fickle. I want to get fickle. All right, July 8, wireless contraception. The chip releases contraceptive hormones to the body until wirelessly advised not to do so. So this is like an implant in your body that's going to do something good for you. And it's going to do it with wireless. All right, next story. Here comes the Panopticon. Here a company saved money on its health insurance premiums by distributing Fitbits and an online service to enable reporting fitness gains back to the insurance company. So they're measuring how much each employee is active. And if, assuming your employees are sufficiently active, then you get a discount on your insurance. Big brother. And then Time Magazine had a related article. It's a different website, but the headline says, Time Magazine shows just how creepy smart homes really are. Well, I'll have the link. You can check it out. That's from July 7. July 4, hacking internet connected light bulbs. Didn't we just talk about that? Oh, it's another story on it. July 1st, report. Comcast's public Xfinity Wi-Fi program actually costs you money. They figure it's about $23 a year. So remember when Comcast was offering everyone that new router? All you have to do is fill out this paperwork and they'll send you one for free. You don't even have to send your old one back in. And then it turns out you do because they're charging you for the old one on your bill. So you send the old one back in and you're ahead of the game, right? You got faster, whatever. Well, it has a public and a private, wireless or Wi-Fi. And so they're separate networks. So in theory, someone who does something illegal on the public portion of your Wi-Fi will not implicate you. However, when you are servicing people publicly from your Wi-Fi hotspot, it's costing you electricity. And they figure that's $23 a year. My little comment here, it took 7 months before anyone talked about that. This is our world today, is introduce bad things, and maybe someone will catch on. Maybe they won't. Who knows? I got some links here. They tested with the router idle and with the router active. They did it in two parts. I'm just trying to see if it's worth reading about it. But anyway, they thorough testing. Bottom line, it costs you money. And your health. Oh, yeah, and your health. Forgot to mention that. July 1st story. Want to blow your monthly bandwidth cap? Use a Kindle Fire TV. All right, well, Kindle Fire is a new product from Amazon. We now live in the age of bandwidth caps. There was a time when the internet wasn't capped on your dial-up connection, and then they started capping it, and they punished the heaviest users, and then we all sort of moved to cable connections and Fios connections, and then they put caps on those. Comcast has a cap on your bandwidth. I think it's 250 gigs up. We've never hit it. I'm not personally complaining about a 250 gig cap. Honestly, I think the people that are, you know, you have to question what they're doing. everything costs, right? If you drive a heavy truck on the roads, you should have to pay more tax. If you use up a lot of bandwidth and you force companies to upgrade, or if you're eating the lion's share of a connection, that should be a relative cost, right? For what it's worth, I think the Comcast 250 gig limit is no big deal. But here's an example where you get a product, you get a TV of all things, and now it's going to use up your cap. Why? Because when you do on-demand from Comcast on your TV, it doesn't cost you bandwidth. Even though it is digital information that's sent, just like everything else, they don't charge you for that because they're already charging you for the cable connection. But when you do it with your Kindle Fire, you're getting it from Amazon. That translates as data to Comcast. And so that show that you're watching in high def from your Amazon account is data that can use up your bandwidth. These are just all these sort of hidden implications. Now, this story is technically not, I don't think it's a wireless story, but maybe the Kindle Fire TV has a wireless component. I don't know. All right, there's a story here I don't have the exact date on. It's probably somewhere in that range, late June, I would say. Two Israeli startup companies are developing the next wave of smart irrigation systems. You know, this smart stuff is going to be everywhere. So your chickens are going to get irradiated. Isn't that great for your chickens? Next story. New steps to protect pollinators, critical contributors to our nation's economy. Save the bees and pass the microwaves, please. Next story. Google Nest announces a new developer program and API. Well, this is kind of like the SDK they announced for the Google Fit. Only the Nest is the smart stuff in your home, right? Well, again, they're making it easier for people to program and steal stuff from you, steal information from you in your Google Nest. And then there's a story on Gizmodo which says the 8 coolest new tricks your Nest can do. Oh, yeah. This is a smart thermostat. You know, the thermostat that sets your temperature. Making your thermostat smart is like coming up with a device that when you sit down, it shovels food in your mouth. I don't want that. I want to put the food in my mouth that I choose, when I choose it, and I want to pause when I feel like pausing. With the temperature in this house, we are adjusting it constantly, manually. We specifically don't go by a program of any kind. It blows my mind that people want a program for the thermostat. It actually blows my mind. Android Auto. Android is from Google. It's licensed to smartphone companies. And it's a competitor to the iPhone, and it's big. The Gizmodo story says, Android Auto turns your dashboard into an Android device. Well, it's just another way to dose yourself with microwave radiation while you're in your car. What do you need it for? I needed MP3 for music. I don't stream it in my car. I have the ability to plug stuff in, and when I plug stuff in, thumb drives, they have music on them, and I listen to them. Or they have whatever I want to listen to, my audiobooks or whatever I want to listen to are on the thumb drives. What on earth do you need this for? When I go somewhere, I don't want to be doing turn-by-turn navigation from a smartphone or a dedicated GPS device. I want to know before I get in the car and turn on the engine and start wasting gas. I want to know where I'm going and how I'm getting there. I use Google Maps. Not counting the new interface, Google Maps is good. I know how to leave my house. I know how to get halfway there. I use Google Maps for the destination, right? I expand it. So to zoom in on it, just the destination component, and I'm like, okay, do I know these roads? Do I know which way is a one-way street or all that kind of stuff? Maybe I print out the map occasionally, and I make a few notes like, all right, when I'm going down 13th Street, I'm going to turn right. All my navigation is done before I get in the vehicle. When I get in the vehicle, I want to be relaxed. That is the number one thing that I've sought and worked at pretty hard, is to be relaxed when I'm in my vehicle. It's paying off, and the bad driver of the week thing is helping. All right, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through all these stories. Let me just start going faster. Headline, 10 non-Google smart home companies. Great, so now there's 10 different competitors to Google for your smart home. Well, we're going to have smart home products, aren't we? Whether we like it or not. Next story, workaholism in America is hurting the economy. This overwork shows up in our sleep. Out of 5 developed peers, 4 other countries sleep more than us. That has again worsened over the years. In 1942, 80% of Americans slept 7 hours a night. Today, 40% sleep 6 hours or less. A lack of sleep makes us poorer workers, yada yada. Well, it's another sleep story. right? Gee, what's causing all this lack of sleep? I don't know. Oh, I got a text. Hang on. Next story. A $99 gadget that makes your oven way smarter. Well, who doesn't want a smart oven? I mean, come on. I've been waiting for that for light years. Basically, it's a smart thermometer. What the heck? You know, you buy a product. Right there next to the ingredients, it says how to cook it. Put it in. 7 minutes. Set a timer, come back, you're done. Seriously, do we need a smart thermometer? What are we cooking in our ovens? Are we building rocket ships in our ovens? What on earth is going on there? It's only $100 for something that's worthless. Wow, what a deal. Next story, should we trust Google with our smart homes? Well, this gets back to the data theft of smart devices, so we've talked about that. Self-contained solar power cube generates electricity, purifies water, and throws Wi-Fi anywhere on Earth. Well, who doesn't need that? All the basics of life, right? Electricity, purified water, and wireless microwave radiation anywhere on Earth. Man, Bill Gates should get behind that. Next story, acoustic sheep. Sleep phones are classic sleep headphones. Oh, and I've got a note here that it's not wireless. And by the way, it's designed by a doctor. Does he know something the press is not telling us? Next story. Well, I am getting near the end here. Turn a Windows 8.1 PC into a Wi-Fi hotspot with the command prompt. This is a life hacker tip. In other words, you need nothing extra to do this. So in other words, your computer could start broadcasting Wi-Fi. And when you hear Wi-Fi hotspot, think of it like set up a drug dealer on your corner. Because given that Wi-Fi is bad, which no one other than the one corrupt organization that the cell phone companies pay to exist, no one is denying that they're bad. It's really just a matter of degree, if anything. Turning your computer into a Wi-Fi hotspot with a command prompt. Well, what that means is someone can send an attachment to you, and they can turn on your Wi-Fi in that attachment. You click on it, and bang. Now you're broadcasting Wi-Fi radiation to yourself and everybody else. Enjoy. Next story, Salesforce and Philips connect doctors to your fitness tracker. Well, this is that theft of information, personal information thing again. Big brother, big Philips. Next story, Google wants its watches everywhere before Apple is anywhere. Well, this is the smart watch fiasco. I don't know. Have you seen these smart watches? In a perfect world, if wireless was completely harmless, would you want a smart watch? A watch that's also a brass band? A watch that's also a canoe? Do we need this? Do we need a watch to do anything but tell time? And of course, nowadays your phone tells time. What do you need the watch for? Now, the one thing is if you go for a jog, something strapped to your wrist is more convenient than carrying something in your hand. But then there's also those little upper arm straps where they put MP3 players there, they put heartbeat monitors, whatever. Do we need a smart watch? I don't think so. If you study this just from an interface point of view, you would never come up with a smart watch. You just would never do it. You would stop before you started. Next story. Google splits up your Android phone for work and play. The latest version of its Android mobile operating system will let you run both business and personal apps on the same phone, while at the same time keeping them separate from each other. So you can use your smart radiation device more often. That's terrific. Microsoft Smart Band coming in October with 11 sensors. This story was in June 28th, so 2 months back. So Microsoft's entry into the smart world. And finally, an article on PC Magazine, I'll have the link, it says, could you live without your phone? That's what's behind all of these stories, right? Could you live without these devices? Will you live with them? Imagine a story that said, could you live without your cigarettes? Could you live without drinking a quart of alcohol a day? Could you live without your phone? You know, there's only one thing causing me to use my phone at all, and that's other people expecting it to be there. In the last couple of months, when I have my phone turned on and I'm at work, I've gotten 2 calls. In both those cases, okay, they needed to get in touch with me. But that's 2 calls in about 3 months. That's how much we need our phones. My phone has smart nothing, It doesn't connect at all anytime except when I turn it on or turn it off. And when I turn it on or turn it off, I walk away. And I come back a minute later. You know, it is possible to use cell phones and have them perform their strict function and nothing else and not get basically killed by them. All right, let's get to the other weeks. Let's have some fun here. Well, this is kind of an appropriate one, a recent story, and it says it's easy to hack traffic lights. Well, guess why? As is typical in large urban areas, the traffic lights in the subject city are networked in a tree-type topology, allowing them to pass information to and receive instruction from a central management point. The network is IP-based, Internet Protocol-based. In order to save on installation costs, the traffic light system uses wireless. The 5.8 GHz network has no password and uses no encryption. And so with a proper radio in hand, joining is trivial. Research team quickly discovered that the debug port was open on the live controllers and could directly, quote, read and write arbitrary memory locations, kill tasks, that's kill programs, like a traffic light program, and even reboot the device that would be disabling the traffic light while it's rebooting. Debug access to the system also lets the researchers look at how the controller communicates to its attached devices. That's the traffic lights and also intersection cameras. They quickly discovered that the control system's communication was totally non-obfuscated. Well, obfuscation is when you make it hard for someone to read what you've written. Leonardo da Vinci, he wrote backwards writing. He had to hold up a mirror to read what was there. That's obfuscation. So they're saying this system is non-obfuscated. In other words, it's trivial to read it. It's wide open. It's like having a big fat security perimeter, and then inside, people have just stacks of money lying around, and everything is, there's no security whatsoever inside. There's no security inside this traffic light system. You just need 5.8 gigahertz device to monitor and connect to it. Unbelievable. Well, that's bad driving stuff right there. That's future bad driving caused by someone hacking the traffic lights, right? Let's do one more here. Daylight savings time and accidents. Monday after daylight saving time is one of the deadliest days on the road, with 17% increase in fatalities. So let's group those two stories and say this is, you know, stuff that shouldn't be a problem, but is. Man getting in the way of man. Man doing something stupid in the case of not having any security on a wireless-based traffic light system. Oh, I've been working on trivia the past week, so that'll be my read or reread of the week. Reading quite a bit of trivia. It's always fun to get a new source. I happened to see someone with a book, and I thought, I'm going to check that out. And then it turned out that there was like 15 or 25 books in that series, and they're all sort of mostly trivia books. So you end up learning a lot along the way about trivial things. It's always money for trivia. Rewatch of the week. I rewatched Robin Williams on Inside the Actor's Studio. This was 2001, so 13 years ago. I've mostly had negative feedback from people regarding Inside the Actor's Studio. TV show by James Lipton, he's the host. He's the man behind it. He teaches at the New School for Acting in New York or something like that. And when he does one of these interviews, and that's what they are, he'll interview some famous person, usually an actor or actress. He will prepare for, I think he prepares for 2 weeks. He gets almost no days off in the year. He's doing this constantly. He reviews their body of work. I don't know, I was going to say in its entirety. Close to it, let's put it that way. He makes notes on note cards. He's famous for these notes. There can be a stack that's multiple inches thick of these note cards. And he's like a prosecutor and you're on the witness stand. Tell me, Floyd, when you were 6, what happened when you were on that camping trip? And you're like, whoa, he knows that? He's amazing. He earns his accolade from me. But what's so interesting is how everyone hates the guy. And you have to ask, why? Well, the answer is that the whole movie industry is a complete and utter scam. It's, hey, look at The Shining. It's, here's what you need to see. Oh, that's yesterday. You need to see this instead. No, no, now you need to see this. No, you need to see this. Keep looking. Here's something new. Have you seen this? And so it's pedal garbage. suck them into watching garbage, move them on to the next garbage. And be careful, don't let anything good get through. Because if you do, they will watch that more than once, and that's a disaster. Well, inside the Actors Studio, what's interesting is there are almost no DVDs with Inside the Actors Studio episodes on them. Almost none. There was like about 8 episodes when, the last time I looked, spread across like 2 sets of DVDs. And of course, you know, Robin Williams passed away, and so I'm like, I'm going to watch it, think about this guy, and who knows, right? You don't know what's going to happen. You watch it because you want to see his manic moments. Well, it was great. Robin Williams is truly outstanding. James Lipton, before the whole interview starts, he says, come with us now, kind of thing, and talking in hushed tones, and he says it was 5 hours long. And true story, as part of this 5 hours of taping and laughing, one person herniated themselves from laughing too much and had to be taken away in an ambulance. Well, only Robin Williams can do that. I'll have the links for that. You can watch it on YouTube. And I guess the raw recording was like an hour and a half. Like if you get it on the DVD, it's like an hour and a half plus extras, something like that. But on TV, it's like, you know, basically 45 minutes plus commercials, right? And by the way, it's shown on the Bravo channel. Bravo channel is possibly the worst channel on television. It is so horrendous that I'll let you decide. But what's so interesting is, while you're trying to watch, you know, like I will check the Bravo channel each day, just in the guide, I'll look ahead. And invariably, day after day after day, there's nothing but horrendous stuff that I could not be paid to watch. And then once in a while, you'll see Inside the Actor's Studio. That's it. You might see a movie occasionally. And we're talking maybe once a month, once every 2 months, there might be one movie worth watching. So then you see Inside the Actor's Studio, you scroll down to that item, then you see, Robin Williams. Well, he was truly outstanding and phenomenal, and the legend lives on videotape now. But what was interesting, and I'm not sure how I came across this, I think what it was is I brought it up on YouTube. I didn't even watch it on YouTube. I had it there, and I was like, I'm going to rewatch it on YouTube. Having just watched it, I'm going to watch it again, you know, at some point in the next week or whatever. And then, you know, off to the right, you know, YouTube has suggestions. And there was a suggested video, and it was by Stefan Molyneux. And it's called The Truth About Robin Williams. Well, this is really worth watching. This guy knows Robin Williams, you know, really well. Like, he's researched it really well. He talks for an hour about this guy. And the bottom line is that Robin Williams had a horrible childhood. And Robin Williams evolved into the man that we all know as a coping mechanism, a way to survive his childhood. Stefan coins the term me plus. Some people realize that just being themselves, just being a kid, isn't enough for their parents, their messed up parents. And so they evolve a me plus. They have to do something else in order to get acceptance from the parents. Robin Williams was this in spades. Some of the interesting points he would make were that Robin Williams turned on when there was more than him and one other person in the room. There had to be 3 or more people before Robin Williams became Mr. Funny. Conversely, when there was just Robin and one other person, he was a different dude. There's a guy, Bob Shimuda, the comic relief guy. He said he knew Robin Williams for some very long time. I think it was like 40 years. And he said he didn't really know the guy. Because, of course, you know, much of his time with Robin is one-on-one, and Robin was basically dried up, not alive, a different person. It's like a seed or something that you add water and it springs to life. It's like those, you know, at Halloween they have those little black discs, and you light the disc, and it starts to flame and smoke, and it expands, and they call them worms and snakes. Well, you have to add the fire to them for anything to happen. And Robin, I guess, was like this very much so. Really kind of a mind-blowing YouTube to watch. And it's what I needed. That's what was missing. And this, of course, explains why Robin Williams took his own life. Because Stefan Molyneux says that what brought Robin Williams down was addiction. Not Robin Williams' addiction, but the addiction of his ex-wives to a lifestyle expectation. which caused them to get multi-million dollar settlements from Robin, something like 40 million, tens of millions each of them, there was two exes, forcing Robin to work even as his health was failing. I guess on one of his performances fairly recently, he had breathing issues or something happened. As Stefan said, you know, it forced Robin Williams to work himself to death to pay the alimony. I guess in Canada, the alimony thing is, well, I'm going to say humorous, because it's so stupid that it's funny. In Canada, let's say Bob is earning $1 million a year. Let's say it's a one-time deal. He writes a book. It's a unique book. It's popular, and he's pulling in the money. He's making $100,000 a month. And let's say at that time, his wife says, I want a divorce, and they divorce. Let's say we're now in the next year after that. Sales are down. Turns out he was lying in his book. Turns out that someone else came up with a better book. Bob's book is not selling very well. Bob's no longer making $1 million. He's making, let's say, $100,000 a year. $10,000 a month. Well, assuming the divorce settlement already passed, and it's based on when you were together, in Canada, they decree that you have to pay. The kids are entitled, and it's all about the kids. You have to have kids for this scam to happen. The kids are entitled to exactly the same money they were getting, they were benefiting from, when you were together with your spouse. And they're entitled to that in perpetuity. In perpetuity. As long as you're alive, those kids are entitled to you making $1 million and giving half of it to them. Them and the spouse. So in other words, that divorce settlement will be for $500,000 a year. But you're only making $100,000. The courts don't care. They literally say, you pay $500,000 a year or you go to jail. I'm not making this up. This isn't some kind of a nightmare that I'm trying to turn into a fiction story. This is really the way it is. There was another guy, Dave Foley, F-O-L-E-Y. He's a comedian. At one point he was doing fantastic, making all kinds of money. His wife was, well, watch the videos. Type in Dave Foley divorce into YouTube. And you can watch the documentary or the interview with him on it. I think it's a Joe Rogan interview. And you will discover that this man's life has become a living hell. He cannot return to Canada. He cannot see his son because there's an impossible divorce settlement. An impossible level of alimony is being levied against this guy forever. Pay it or else. Dave Foley's case, the settlement was $17,000 a month. What family needs $17,000 a month? You know, just intuitively, that's probably what? I'm going to say four times too high. And it's clearly based on the money was coming in and we spent it. Period of time, right? But why is it locked in? You know, there was a time when, you see, there's alimony and then there's child support. And in alimony, it'll be a percentage of your wages. But in child support, in Canada, it's a designated amount regardless. Well, Robin didn't have the lunatic Canadian settlement to deal with, but he did have ex-wives who took tens of millions. And basically, Robin was broke and had to be on the road. And apparently, his TV show, The Crazies, it was canceled. So now he's faced with how is he going to make the money, right? What are his prospects, right? You're forced to make these payments. These ludicrous payments. You have no choice. So, there was a video game called, I think it was called something 360 or 720. It might have been the name of it, 720. The idea being that when you go around twice in the air, it's a 720. And in this skateboard video, you would like do stuff and get points. And then the timer would kick in and you had to skate to a park and do a contest or your game would be over. And when that timer kicked in, you would hear this voice. Skate or die, skate or die, skate or die. And you had to race to this park and then do this little thing. Well, that's what Robin Williams was faced with. Perform or die. Allow these women addicted to ridiculous levels of money to suck money out of you or die. Stefan Molyneux, the truth about Robin Williams, worth a watch, to say the least. Totally puts it all in perspective for me, totally. Robin Williams took his life because of divorce settlements, according to Stefan Molyneux, and it seems a very reasonable conclusion. In short, Robin realized, I've had the greatest moments of my life. There are no great moments left. There is no sitting in an easy chair for me. I have an impossible task in front of me. Why bother? So that was my watch of the week. The rewatch being the Inside the Actor's Studio with Robin Williams. You know, they're sort of like two halves of the coin, right? Robin Williams, the genius, the one and only. And then Robin Williams, another victim of divorce settlements. Powerful stuff. All right, we're running long here. We're 100 minutes in raw recording time, so I'm going to warp down to the quote of the week. This is probably appropriate. It's from Lily Tomlin. I've had it in my file for a while. No matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up. Well, boy, isn't that true. Robin Williams was so cynical that he took his own life. He looked at the future of his life and he was like, I'm going to sell my life short. I'm going to bet against me. That's what he did. He bet against himself. I bet it's better for me not to be here. That's pretty cynical. Life made Robin Williams cynical, arguably. Wireless is making me cynical about progress, in quotes. No matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up. Well, you know, that's an old person's quote, right? If it's a young person's quote, that young person's going to have an unhappy life. You know, you have to have a period of your life where you're optimistic, where you're young, dumb, and full of fun. Something like that. Oh, dear. But as you get older, if your brain is working, it's certainly possible that you will become cynical. But, you know, even with that, you have to be able to take all that, put it to one side, and go, there are these interesting things in life. And there are. It's beautiful outside. It's not raining. It's still summer. There's optimism in the air. My raspberry canes, the canes are growing fantastic, and they're going to put out another crop of raspberries. We got flowers that we chop down. They normally only do one crop. I've been watering a lot this year. They're going to produce more flowers. You know, there's reason for optimism in life. As long as you don't get divorced, apparently. This has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 28 for August 25th, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.